Strategic communication. This is our next topic, and we will discuss it with Dr. Neville Ball, Director of King's College Center for Strategic Communications. Hello, sir.
Hello.
So first of all, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with this field of research, what is strategic communications?
Let me give you a couple of ways of looking at it. One, very simply, in a nutshell, it is about the shifting and shaping of major discourses that have implications in the future. One that is more detailed is to say, well, it is the projection of foreign and security policy by governments aimed at targeted audiences with the objective of achieving strategic effects, namely changes in attitude and behavior of those targeted audiences. And some people would say it is in the national interest. I would say it's in the national interest or in the interest of a political community. Because if it's in the national interest, it suggests only states do strategic communications. I think other political movements do strategic communications. So I'm thinking about the difference, for example, between, if I asked you, do you think Al-Qaeda does strategic communications? Do you think Daesh, ISIS, ISIL did strategic communications? Well, if strategic communications is limited to states, then Al-Qaeda doesn't qualify. But ISIS does, because it was an embryonic state, even though it only lasted as a state, as an organic being, for a year or two. By state, I mean an entity that administers a population and offers monopoly over legitimate violence, social security, healthcare, judiciary, policing, those basics that we associate with a state. So you can see that strategic communications also, in that sense, is still controversial, because some people say, no, only states do it. Some people say only Western states do it, because it's about fundamentally, it's about democracy. And others say, no, major political players in the world also do strategic communications. You don't have to be a state. That's a very long way of trying to explain a very short question. I'm sorry.
That's fine. So maybe we'll talk about the implications of strategic communications all around the world. And you can give us a surely well-known example.
Okay.
About Russia and Western states.
Okay. In March 2018, in the United Kingdom, in a small town called Salisbury, a former Russian spy, a former Russian double agent, and his daughter were nearly killed, murdered, by what appears to have been two members of Russia's military intelligence. They came into contact with a poison, high-grade poison that emanates from military sources. The response to it by the British government was a measured response, a careful response, but it had to be quite a quick response as well. And in the meantime, as the government was trying to collect evidence, where had this poison come from, who were the likely perpetrators, meanwhile, Russia started to put out stories saying, well, it could be this, it could be that. 3 months later, coming out of Moscow and St. Petersburg, there had been something like 43 different explanations, which were completely different. And there was a very clear strategy going on. And the strategy was, it wasn't about any of those individual 43 messages that Russia was putting out, it was about all of them. The idea was to subvert the political status quo, creating to a certain extent chaos. where the strategic communications, so that was the kind of, you might say, a strategic opportunist view of strategic communications coming out of Moscow. The British response was to say, we have to test it, but it is highly likely, not proven, but highly likely that it came out of Russia. The result of all this was that there was a kind of tit for tat that developed. Britain expelled Russian diplomats. Washington expelled Russian diplomats. European Union countries did the same. Russia, in return, expelled British diplomats and closed down the British Council. This projects it onto an international stage, clearly, because it takes it out of Britain and it disseminates it across supportive Western democratic states who feel under threat. But the whole package becomes part of a strategic communications project, if you think about it like that. In a less specific way, and one which Western states are currently struggling to come to terms with, is the rise of China. And there are two elements to that. Because Western states are trying to work out, what is it that China is trying to do? What is China actually trying to say when it speaks to the world? Because there are two things happening. One is the Belt and Road Initiative, One Belt, One Road, which the Chinese president already in 2014 was saying, this is the biggest global soft power project since the Marshall Plan in the 1940s, 50s. That came out of the United States, and that we, China, are doing this for the benefit of the world to generate trade, because what they were doing was creating new Silk Roads, as opposed to the old Silk Roads, that stretch all the way from China all the way to Western Europe, through Central Asia, Eastern Europe to Western Europe. This all sounds good. This sounds like good diplomacy, public diplomacy. On the other hand, in the East China Sea and in the South China Sea, China is exerting its territorial ambitions, and it says its territorial sovereignty through kinetic, military, naval clashes in the East China Seas and South China Seas with the Japanese, but also exerting claims on territory, waters, parts of the sea, the ocean, vis-a-vis the Philippines, vis-a-vis Vietnam, and so on. So what appears on the kinetic side, on the side of, let's call it hard force, appears to be quite a bellicose, or at least a militarized China trying to exert its power. On the other side, you have what appears to be a very friendly China trying to exert economic regeneration of the global economy. When you put them together, what are you looking at? This is the difficulty. So, put in short, do we in the West think China are the good guys or the bad guys, if you put it into really brutal terms? And we're struggling to understand that, because what we're looking at is ambiguity. And it's not clear. The Russian situation is pretty clear, because Putin has repeatedly shown that his ambitions are purely for rebuilding a Russian empire. And that can only be done at the expense of Western states.
So, last but not least, if you can just shortly say some words about the challenges for democracies in view of these events that you've just mentioned.
The challenges for Western democracies really go to a different point. And for strategic communicators, it's important to try to see a picture that stretches across the world. Democracies are on the back foot. They're being pushed, they're being threatened, and they're being infiltrated by authoritarian regimes. So China, again, President of China has said on more than one occasion, democracy as a form of governance is no longer fit for purpose. Democracy has had its time. It's had its 200 years in the sunshine. Complex modern societies require more authoritarian, more controlled forms of administration. And that kind of thinking is being pressed onto the world through China's economic leverage and its diplomatic initiatives. In Eastern Europe, you have democracies who sit within the European Union, but are effectively not maybe as far as Russia has gone, where democracy, they do have elections in Russia, but nobody believes that in them at all. In Eastern Europe, you have states which use the tools of democracy, but actually are very much more focused on strongman politics. So it is an illiberal form of democracy. And then there's the rest of us who are internally struggling with what we've always understood as democracy, and where the democracy is being re-examined internally for a variety of reasons. So if you look at Spain, look at the, you know, Barcelona protests and see what effect that's having on democracy and questions around democracy. You know, look at Greece, same thing over the last few years. Look at the United Kingdom and Brexit. There you have two forms of democracy going head to head. Direct democracy, brackets, referendum, versus versus representative democracy, brackets, parliamentary democracy. So democracy is being questioned by democratic citizens and electorates. The net effect of that is that the conversation around democracy and democratic governance is probably, and I think it's quite right that it always should be, but at the moment, it is the most burning issue, and we have to address it.
Thank you very much.